Thank you. Can everybody hear me out there? Delightful. Okay. Today I'm going to talk to you about CROM, which is a framework for building speculative JavaScript applications that run inside unmodified browsers. So let's begin. The internet. People love it. It's a series of tubes. And one of the things that people do with the internet is that they use it to surf the web. Now, when people download these web pages, they want these things to download very quickly. This makes them feel very responsive, like a desktop app. Now, unfortunately, sometimes the internet tubes get clogged. So the purpose of this research project is to reduce the user-perceived fetch latency for these web pages. And in particular, what we're going to do is we want to prefetch web data so that it already resides on the user's machine by the time that he or she requests it. Now, prefetching was very easy in the old days of the web because essentially the web was a set of static objects connected by declarative links. So all you had to do to prefetch was traverse the static graph and just fetch the objects. So for example, here is Microsoft's first web page. As you can tell, our logo used to be a cauldron of awesomeness. And if you look at the HTML for that cauldron, you'll see that there's a bunch of statically declared links in there. So a prefetching browser could simply traverse this HTML, find the targets for those links, and download them and put them on the user's machine. Now, in the Brave Web 2.0 world, things are much different, right? And the reason is that that content graph is no longer static and declarative. Instead, a lot of content is dynamically named by means of imperative JavaScript event handlers. So, for example, if you go to your favorite mapping application, you double-click on a particular tile, you're going to cause the invocation of a JavaScript event handler, which is going to change the zoom level of the map and do some other stuff. But importantly, it's also going to fetch data to warm the browser cache. It's going to get those tiles, and it's going to display them. So this is actually a challenge to prefetching, the fact that now these data fetches are triggered by the imperative JavaScript event handlers. And the reason that it's challenging to prefetch now is because you can't just pre-execute those event handlers to warm the cache. And the reason is because these event handlers actually have side effects. So as you can see here, not only does the event handler fetch the tiles, but it also changes the zoom level and update other application state. So if we just pre-execute that handler, then we're just going to put the application in an inconsistent state, right? Because we'll have warmed the cache, but the map is actually going to zoom and the user didn't click on anything. So you can't just pre-execute these things. So the point here is that a prefetcher for these JavaScript-based web applications has to understand JavaScript, and in particular, has to hide the side effects of speculation until commit time. Now, another challenge of prefetching in this brave new world is that the fetches are often driven by user-generated inputs, okay? And those inputs can be as simple as I'm going to click on a download button, or they can be as unconstrained as I'm going to type something into a search form, okay? Now, in the latter case, things become tricky because essentially there are a combinatorial number of user inputs that we could speculate on. For example, if I go to Bing, you know, I might want to type in Shakespeare. I might want to type in Britney Spears. Sometimes I type in stuff not appropriate for a PG-13 talk. That's not the point. The point is that it's infeasible to speculate upon all possible user inputs. So what you want to do is you only want to speculate on a constrained set of inputs that are reasonable given the current state of the web page. So there are prior solutions to this, right? A lot of the sophisticated web apps that you already use do some form of speculation. For example, web-based email clients might speculatively upload a message. Image galleries or mapping applications often speculatively prefetch tiles. Now, the advantage of all this custom speculation code is that you can produce highly targeted, highly performant speculations. But the disadvantage is that it's often very difficult to write the speculation code. And furthermore, it's typically tightly integrated with the application's code base, meaning that it's not easily shared with other applications. So to address these problems, we came up with a tool called CROM, which is a generic speculation engine for JavaScript. CROM itself is implemented as regular JavaScript, so you can run it on browsers with no modifications to them. And what CROM-enabled applications do is that they express their speculative intents to CROM. They answer a series of high-level questions, like which event handler should be speculative? At what point in the application's execution should speculation occur? And given a particular application state, how can we figure out what reasonable speculative user inputs are? So given the answers to those high-level questions, CROM is going to take care of the lower level details of speculation in a very patriotic way, obviously. So what CROM is going to do, it's going to automatically clone the browser state. It's going to rewrite event handlers so when they run, they only read and write from that shadow browser state. Then later, if the user actually generates a speculated upon input, CROM is going to automatically commit that speculative context, having already paid the fetch latency to build that context. Now, CROM also provides some other assorted goodness, such as an API to make it easier to write applications that speculatively upload things. But I'm going to defer everything in the bottom half of this slide to the paper, and I'm just going to talk about the top half of the slide in this talk. So here's an outline for the rest of the presentation. I'm essentially going to go through step by step. We're going to talk about how we clone the browser state, how we rewrite handlers, how we commit speculative context. Then I'm going to give you some optimizations that we had to implement to make everything performant when CROM is implemented as a regular JavaScript library. Finally, I'll give you a couple slides of evaluation. Then I'll briefly touch on related work before concluding. So here's a very simple example we'll use for the next couple slides to see how a developer would add speculative execution to their application. So here we see a text div that the user can click on and cause something to happen, in this case the incrementing of a simple counter. Now in this JavaScript here, we define that global counter, which we initialized to 42 because we are, of course, computer scientists. We then go on and define two other functions which are going to manipulate that counter. And finally, in this piece of JavaScript, this is when we actually associate F2, the function, as the event handler for clicking on that div. Now, to speculate on the clicking of that div, here's what the developer would say. The developer would add these two CROM calls, crom.makeSpeculative, which is essentially going to say to CROM, hey, here's the event handler that I want you to speculate upon. Then the call to crom.speculate actually tells CROM, hey, go out and issue that speculation. So let's look behind the scenes and see what these invocations do. So first, they need to clone the browser state. And there are two pieces of browser state that have to be cloned here. First, there's what we call the application heap. This is all the JavaScript objects that are reachable from the roots of the global namespace. And applications can explicitly reference this namespace by means of the special global window variable. So for example, if an application says window.x, that actually refers to the global variable x. So we need to clone that. We also need to clone the DOM tree, which is a special JavaScript structure which represents the page's HTML. So each HTML tag in a page has a corresponding DOM node object. So the application can change the visual layout of the page by manipulating the JavaScript DOM tree in certain ways. So here's how we clone the application heap. It's actually pretty straightforward. We essentially walk the object graph and just deep copy everything. Essentially, we start with an initially empty object, the spec window, the speculative window, the speculative namespace. And then we iterate over the properties of the real window and just deep copy everything over. So that deep copying for objects and primitives is actually fairly straightforward. Functions are a little bit trickier because in JavaScript, functions are actually first-class objects. And the other neat thing about functions in JavaScript is that you can call their toString method and you get the source code of that method. So to clone a function, essentially we call eval on its source string to create a semantically equivalent function, and then we deep copy any object properties that that function might have. Now how do we clone the DOM tree? Well, as we can see up here, the DOM tree is essentially a tree, no surprise there, and each DOM node can have style attributes, they can have event handlers, you can also have other application defined properties. So the first thing we do to clone the DOM tree is we call this natively defined browser provided method called clone node on the root of that DOM tree, the body tag. And what that's going to do is copy over the entire graph structure of the DOM tree, and it's also going to copy over the style attributes. Now, you know that the event handlers and the application properties have not actually been copied over by this node, by that method. So CROM has to actually come in and traverse the tree itself and add those things in, and that's actually fairly slow because that takes place in regular JavaScript code as opposed to native C++ code running inside the browser. So putting this all together, here's how we clone a browser context. So the first thing we do is we create an invisible iframe, and we clone the DOM tree, and we stick that new DOM tree inside the invisible iframe. Then we create the new global JavaScript namespace, as I explained before. Then those last two lines just make sure that whenever speculative code is going to refer to window, it's going to go to our spec window as opposed to the real window. And that final line actually says, hey, when the speculative code uses DOM operations, use our speculative DOM tree. So you do all this, and congratulations. You are now the parent of a brand new shadow browser context. That is an amazing picture. You're welcome for that. So now, the next thing we need to figure out how to do is how we actually rewrite event handlers to use this shadow browser context. So JavaScript is lexically scoped. Activation records are essentially just objects that map variable names to variable values. And so you resolve a reference to a variable simply by following a chain of scope objects. So for example, here's the example top-level code I've been showing you before with the global variable and the two functions. So let's say that we want to call F2. Well, the source code of F2 wants to get the value of global var. So first it's going to look in the scope object for F2, And it's not going to find any reference to global var there. So it's going to pop up the scope chain in the global scope. It will find a binding for global var there, and so everything is fine and dandy. So what we're going to do in Chrome is take advantage of JavaScript's with ob statement, which allows us to insert an object to the front of the scope chain. So essentially what Chrome's rewrite function does is the following. So given a function to rewrite and a specket of global JavaScript namespace, the rewrite function wraps the original function source code in a with spec window statement that pushes spec window to the front of the scope chain. And this is going to allow us to do something pretty neat. So suppose that, once again, we have the three global declarations we had before, and we're going to rewrite F2. So what's going to happen now? So we call F2 prime. It's going to want to access global variable. And so it's going to look in the spec window object that's been pushed to the front of its scope chain. It is going to find a reference to global var there, and so it's going to read and it's going to write that speculative version of global var. We're not going to go all the way up the scope chain and actually touch that real version. Now, there are various details about rewriting event handlers. I'm not going to go into detail here. For example, how do you handle closures? How do you handle speculative code that adds or deletes global variables? But suffice it to say, in this example, we have this function F2. The way that we rewrite it is, once again, wrapping its source code in a with spec window statement. And then the inner calls that it makes, so for example, here to F1, well, we also have to rewrite F1. We do that lazily. And so when we do that, that ensures that everything in the event handler's call chain gets rewritten to only access the speculative state. So, given all that, now we see what these two calls to Chrome do. So, the make speculative call clones the browser state and rewrites that event handler, and then the Chrome.speculate call says go out and actually run this rewritten handler using that cloned browser context that you've already created. So, now let's talk about how Chrome commits speculative context. First of all, suppose you've got a bunch of speculative context laying around and you know which one that you want to commit, okay? So committing is actually fairly simple. So first you commit the speculative DOM tree, and that's essentially just a pointer swap. You just take the real DOM pointer in the real domain and just make it point to that speculative DOM tree we put in that invisible iframe. The second thing that you want to do is commit the application heap. This is also fairly straightforward too. You just iterate through all the names in the spec window object, and you just copy them over using pointer swaps. And then finally, if the speculative context actually deleted some global variables, well, you just delete those from the real namespace as well. So that all is pretty straightforward, but this begs the question, how do you know which speculative context you want to commit if you've got a bunch of them laying around? So the way that you figure that out is using this principle called start state equivalence, which I've described in the successively wordy slide here. So basically, start state equivalence says you can only commit a speculative context if two things are the case. First of all, the start state for that speculative context has to have been equivalent to the application's current state. Second of all, the speculative input that mutated that speculative context has to be equivalent to the real currently issued input. And so the application is going to define an equivalence function, which is essentially just a hash function over a global namespace, a speculative one or a real one. And a speculative context can only commit if its hash matches that of the current real namespace. And then applications also define these things we call mutator functions, which tell Chrome how to change a speculative context that it's just created before running the speculative event handler. So you hear all that, and you're probably thinking, that's the most confusing, ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Luckily, using my amazing skills of pedagogy, I'm going to provide you an illuminating example. So suppose that, once again, we want to speculate on what people type into Bing, the world's most popular search engine. So the mutator, that was not intended to be a joke, by the way. So the mutator is going to be very simple. It's essentially going to take in a speculative namespace and a speculative input, and it's going to say, set the search text in that speculative context to be this speculative input value. The state hash is also going to be very simple. It's going to take in a global namespace, a real one or a speculative one, and the hash for that state is simply the value of its search text. And finally, we see this called a chrome.makeSpeculative, and compared to that simpler example I gave you before, we've added three new arguments. We're passing in the mutator function, the state hash, and then an argument vector here, which is saying, Chrome, I want you to speculate, in this case, on housing and tulips, two historically safe bets for speculation. So here's what happens behind the scenes. Initially, the application starts out in the state S empty quotes. The user hasn't typed anything into the text box. So Chrome is going to clone that browser context, and initially those clones are exact copies of the browser state. Then it's going to call the mutator function. Essentially, it's going to insert housing or tulips into that text box, simulating the user's speculative input. Then it's going to actually speculate. It's going to go out. It's going to fetch objects, et cetera, warm the cache, pre-compute the layout, stuff like that. Okay, so now let's come back to the real world. So in the real world, that text box is initially empty. And let's say in the real world, the user does actually want to speculate on housing. Okay, fine. So what happens now is that Crom is going to look in its set of shadow contexts and say, do I have one that has a matching state hash with the current real non-speculative domain? In this case, the answer is yes. So we commit that speculative context that we already have, and we've essentially masked all the fetch latency and all the latency needed to lay out that content on the screen. So you might be wondering, what happens if an application doesn't specify any start state equivalent data? In other words, what if it calls make speculative and it doesn't pass in the mutator and the state hash and so on and so forth? Well, in that case, Crom has to throw away all the speculations it's made whenever any event handler executes, and then it has to respeculate on everything else. And the reason is because lacking the start state equivalent data, it can't guarantee commit safety. So as you can imagine, this might lead to some waste if you actually throw away a context that you could have potentially committed later. So we expect that in the common case, applications will provide this SSE data. So now let me give you one optimization that we use to make this all performant in regular JavaScript code instead of having a native in-browser implementation. So the key optimization we make is that you don't need to copy the entire heap forest. Right? We can actually use lexical analysis to look at which variables the event handler actually is going to touch. And we only need to clone that particular set of heap variables. And we essentially lazily clone them at rewrite time. Now, this is a great savings, right? Because now this is going to cut down the cloning overhead from, you know, proportional to the total number of JavaScript objects in the entire page to proportional to how many JavaScript objects you actually touch. However, this introduces new problems. So suppose that before we do any speculation, we have the scene that we see up here. We have two objects, X and Y. These are both global namespace objects. And they both point to a shared object Z. So let's say that the speculative event handler is going to touch Y dot Z. So our lexical analysis will say, aha, we found a global heap tree that we need to clone. It starts at Y. Okay, fine. We're going to clone a version of Y. And then we go about our merry business as before. So now we commit Y and its whole object tree, once again, just by doing a pointer swap, okay? And so there's a problem here, because now Y and X point to different versions of Z. And that's a problem, because X's version of Z is now stale. So this is obviously a case of bad parenting. And so what we need to do to solve this is actually add some bookkeeping and add some checks at commit time. So here's the same picture of pre-speculation that I showed you before. And now what we're going to do before we actually issue a speculation is actually walk the entire object graph and add parent pointers for all the objects. And we're also going to assign each object a unique integer ID. So at speculation time, we do what we did before. So in this case, we clone Y's object tree. Now commit time is going to be a little bit different. So once again, we commit the speculative version of Y's tree by doing that pointer swap. But then what we're going to do is we're going to look at all the IDs of the objects that are committed. In this case, it's 1 and 2. Then we're going to look at the IDs of their parents. In this case, it's 0 and 1. And we're going to say to ourselves, are all the parent IDs in the committed set of IDs? If the answer is no, we know that we've detected one of these stale parent-child relationships. And so in this case, we see that X actually has a stale reference. And so we can just use our parent pointers to go back in and patch that up. So essentially what all this means is there are now three speculation modes that Crom can use. So there's the full copy mode, where you clone the entire application heap for every speculation. Now this is always going to be safe, in the sense that you're never going to have these poor or these stale child references. However, it may be slow, because for web pages that have very large application heaps, you may have to copy a lot of data. And furthermore, the copy cost is non-amortizable across multiple speculations because each speculation needs its own copy of that heap. Now, what I just showed you in the previous few slides is called what we call checked lazy mode. So this is where we use that neat lexical analysis to only copy stuff that things look at, but we use parent tracking to detect the stale child references at the end. So this is always safe. You never have stale child references. And the parent mapping cost is amortizable across multiple speculations that share the same initial start state. However, the parent mapping may or may not be slow, depending on how dense the object graph is and how many objects there are. So there's also something we call unchecked lazy mode, which is where we do the lazy copying that I just described to you, but we don't build the parent map, and we don't actually check anything at commit time. So this is obviously the fastest method. It's often safe in practice.
we found, looking at the applications we've talked about in the evaluation section. But strictly speaking, this does not guarantee that there will be no stale child references. And so there is a mode that Chrome can run in called checked mode refactoring, which is essentially the checked lazy mode from bullet 2. But what Chrome will do is it will output the child references that it's actually fixing up that were stale at commit time. So what the developer can do is initially run stuff in checked lazy mode, see what stale references are being patched, and then typically the developer can make some very simple changes to the code so that in the new version, you don't have these stale references. Then you can run the speculation in unchecked lazy mode, and everything goes very quickly, and it's also safe. So now I'm going to give you a couple slides of evaluation. So we looked at several of applications in the paper. The one I'm going to discuss today is the DHTML tab manager. Essentially, it's a bundle of JavaScript code which allows you to create tabbed GUIs for your web pages, like you might see on Facebook, where I spend 90 to 95% of my time these days. And so what we speculated here in this case is we speculated on the user clicking the Create a New Tab button. And what that button did is it went out and did an AJAX fetch for the CNN homepage, which is a very complicated page, a lot of JavaScript, a lot of fancy DOM scripts, DOM stuff. And we essentially put all that content in the new tab. And so we embedded the tab manager code inside the ESPN web page, which is also another very complex web page. Now, the reason that we did that kind of weird embedding is because we wanted to see if our lazy cloning optimizations would be successful in making the cloning overhead be proportional to the amount of state that the speculation touched, not the total amount of states. That's why we embedded all this code inside this much bigger JavaScript environment. So the key question we want to see here is, can we hide Chrome's computational overhead in user think time? Because if the answer is yes, then Chrome doesn't have to be as computationally efficient as custom code. It merely has to be fast enough. And if it's fast enough, then you can get almost all of the benefits of hiding fetch latency, even though you haven't written this and a tightly crafted code that's application specific. So here we see Chrome's computational cost in unchecked lazy mode. And so, we break these costs into two parts: the pre-speculation cost, which is sort of on the left, and then the during commit costs, which are on the right. So long story short, the pre-speculation costs on the left are trivial. They only sum up to about 24 milliseconds. One of the biggest components at about 10 milliseconds was the lexical analysis inside the rewriting. But those costs are very easily hideable within user think time. Now, at commit time, we see that there's 77 milliseconds of overhead. But note that of that time, 99% of that was devoted to actually committing that DOM pointer a swap when we commit the speculative DOM tree. And note that that cost has to be paid even by non-speculative code. Any code that updates the DOM state is going to pay this cost. So essentially, Chrome is adding no overhead at commit time. Now, here are what Chrome's costs are when we run in checked lazy mode. Now, in comparison to the previous graph that I showed you, there are two new sources of overhead, okay? Pre-speculation time, there's 158 milliseconds of overhead for creating the parent map, going through the whole object cycle and creating those parent back pointers. And we also see that at commit time, there's the cost of fixing those stale parent-child relationships. So creating the parent map is actually fairly expensive, 158 milliseconds. So that leads to a total pre-commit overhead of about 182 milliseconds. Now, for many applications, this is fine. This will fit within user think time. Typically, many web pages are not CPU intensive, so usually this is fine. Now, in the paper, we give you examples where this may not be acceptable for some applications. So for some applications, you may only be able to run Chrome in unchecked lazy mode efficiently. Now, we see at commit time, we have an overhead of about 5 milliseconds. And that overhead is actually pretty small. And the reason why it's so small is that the overhead of checking those stale parent-child relationships is proportional to the number of objects that were cloned, not to the total number of objects in the web page. And since that total number is much smaller than the total number of objects, that overhead is very small. And finally, here's the most important thing here, which is here's the user-perceived reduction in the latency for constructing that tab. And so what we have on the x-axis is the server fetch latency. On the y-axis, we have this amount of time that the browser needed to fetch all the objects and then do the final repaint to the screen, which from the user's perspective means everything here is done. And so this graph essentially just shows you that, you know, speculation in general and Chrome in particular gives you the expected benefits for prefetching. So for example, if we look here, we see 200 milliseconds of artificial server latency, then then Chrome only needs about 400 milliseconds to build the page, but a regular browser running with a cold cache needs over 3 seconds to complete the build. So now I'll just briefly give you some related work before concluding. So obviously we stand on the shoulders of giants. We did not create speculation, nor do we claim to, and so many of you are probably already familiar with the related work I list here. Now, Chrome has sort of 3 contributions to the literature. First of all, we're going to exploit language introspection in an interesting way, we think, to, in a sense, make applications self-modify to become speculative. Second, a lot of the prior work on speculation is focused on, well, can we speculate on the result of the output of programs or the computers? We actually want to provide a framework for speculating on user intents. And finally, unlike a lot of proposals from the web-based community that focus on prefetching static HTML content, we focus on dynamically named content. So in conclusion, prefetching is very, very difficult in rich internet applications. And the reason is because you have to actually think about JavaScript and its side effects. And so applications can already do sort of custom speculative solutions, but this code can be difficult to write and you can't actually share it. It makes Darth Vader sad, and even he has feelings. So what we've introduced is Chrome, which is a generic JavaScript speculation engine. And we think it's kind of interesting because essentially what it allows applications to do is specify very high-level speculative intents. And then Chrome will take care of the low-level details involved in making that speculation a reality. And so given that Chrome, even though it has some computational overhead, can easily fit that within think time, we see that Chrome provides the expected and somewhat obvious reductions in fetch latency because prefetching obviously works. We all took a graduate student operating systems class. So with that, I will conclude and take any questions. Thank you.
Hi.
Oh. Howdy.
Hi. Ryan Peterson, Cornell. So first of all, I am in awe of your JavaScript hacking skills. And
thank you, sir.
Second, the JavaScript side of a web application is only half of the web application, right?
Yep.
The other half is the server, which can be very interactive as well and have side effects of its own that might even be harder to reason about. Even in your examples here that look like they're read-only, such as a Bing search, if everyone in the world were using speculative execution on their client, you would get a lot of logging errors or a lot of most of your logs would be inaccurate and show all of these speculative.
That's right. So there's one issue, which is, you shouldn't, let's put it like this. Chrome relies on the developer to say, I want Chrome to make these things speculative. As a developer, you shouldn't be speculating on, let's buy a Ferrari on Amazon.com. That's a poor thing to do. It has side effects, right? I mean, sort of the more sort of technical answer to that is, in the paper we do discuss how do you handle essentially mutating ops on the server side, right? And essentially you have to reason about that on the client side as well. So essentially you have to have sort of explicit understanding on the client side of, in this speculation, here's the read portion of it, here's the write portion of it, and the server has to understand that. So the simplest example is an email server, right? So let's say you prefetch a message that might change some flags on it. The message was read, was not read, stuff like that. You have to be able to roll that stuff back. So you're absolutely right about that. And so I'll defer you to the paper for more details on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Wyatt Lloyd, Princeton University. I was wondering if you guys looked at the computational costs on the client and if these would sort of interfere if you had multiple tabs running with Chrome. Would sort of multiple tab Chromes screw up the main tab, and is there going to be contention here, and does the speculation screw up the regular experience?
Multiple tab Chromes is actually the name of our next NSDI paper. So that, of course, is not true. So the answer is yes. I mean, there are going to be sort of linear overheads, if you will, running Chrome multiple tabs. Now, what we showed in our evaluation is that in the common case, those overheads are actually quite small. And one thing that we can take advantage of is that most JavaScript applications are not CPU bound at all. And in fact, most of the time, they're actually waiting for the network. So if you use the optimizations that I showed you, the unchecked lazy mode, that will never be a problem, or shouldn't be a problem in the common case. Now, if you want to, say, copy the entire application heap, yes, you will run into problems there. And in fact, the reason why we came up with those optimizations is because we were locking the browser, basically what you were suggesting. We were copying the whole heap, and we were getting a little spinning circle of death, and that was unacceptable. But if you use the optimizations, you should be fine.
Thank you.
Sadly, we don't have enough time for another question, so I'll...